Welcome to the Gritty Hour. Time to get down to the nitty gritty.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Gritty Hour. I'm here with Professor Bob Pucci. Welcome back to the Gritty Hour, Bob.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Professor Pucci has been on previous podcasts when we were discussing the state of education. Professor Pucci taught, recently retired, correct?
Yes, as of May.
You taught media and communications in college, mm-hmm. at the college level. So we wanted to have him back to discuss what I'm just curious, what makes a great movie great and the elements that go into it. And hopefully we talk about, you know, cinematography, screenplay, directing, set design, right. That kind of stuff. So that's it. That's all I really wanted to have you on for. I appreciate you coming on. I wanted to talk about the classic movies.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, the classic movies are, you know, kind of, if you will, the foundation of a lot of the elements, because, you know, basically film does not derive, as most people might think, from the theater, because, you know, in the theater, there are certain limitations. As a spectator, you are limited to what you can see by your seat location and your ability to get closer to the action is somewhat limited.
In
the theater. And so film created a whole new idea I call it transportation of time and space. And while there are some wonderful effects that occur in the theater that that do this, you know, a lot of those, you know, kind of like, you know, learned a little bit from how film works, you know. And so we're going to go through the various elements that go into a film and how they contribute to what make a film great. And the first thing I wanted to say when we talk about great, you know, there's an objective and subjective way of looking at a film.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of times people will look at a film in a subjective way. I thought it was great. I thought it was wonderful. It was great. It was very funny, whatever. And they could be right. You know, it could also be a very well-made, well-designed, well-executed film. But we also have what I call guilty pleasures. You know, we'll enjoy a film that, quite frankly, is not a very good film. And we enjoy it because of the actors. We enjoy it because of the subject matter or the kind of film that it is. And we might be blind, if you will, to how the elements are working or not working. Now, a lot of times on the first class, my students will say, is this going to ruin watching a movie for me? And I say, no, not at all. Except that, you know, if a movie is really well made, you are subliminally aware of the elements, and the elements are working to make the film very good, but you're not sitting there critiquing them. Now, if the film is bad, however, you know, you can't help but notice, you know, why it's not working. You know, and so when you take a look at these elements, you know, a lot of times when it's not working, we might start with the first one, which has to do with structure and story and dialogue, character development, and so on and so forth. And a lot of times people don't realize that a film has an act structure, three acts. In the first act, you set up the situation, you introduce the protagonist, maybe the antagonist, and you introduce the obstacle that the protagonist has to overcome. And in the second act, we see how that obstacle evolves and perhaps gets more complicated. Now, right in the middle of the movie, there is a change. I like to sometimes, someone will say twist, you know, but there'll be something that changes the direction, because by now the audience has developed some kind of anticipation as to how it's going to play out. And so you have to give them a little I don't know, surprise, if you will, and suggest that no, it's not solved quite yet. I guess the first, the greatest example, the easiest example to talk about is like a caper film, where the first half of the film is the planning of the job. And usually in the middle of the film, the job is executed. And the money is taken and whatever. And now the rest of the movie is how it plays out. Do they get to keep the money? Is there honor among thieves? Is there a falling out? How does it turn out? Mm-hmm. You know, and so you've got that. The first half is like building up to this moment. And it looks like, well, you know, you could end the movie right there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of my favorite examples of this is the original Italian Job, where the whole movie is about this very complicated heist and automobiles and everything, and then it winds up that the gold that they steal is on this bus, and the guy who's driving the bus drives it over the edge of a cliff. And all the gold is threatening to leave the bus and also topple them over the edge of the cliff. And it's the literal cliffhanger, you know, and so, you know, film has this ability to take us through an experience. And the act structure is really very much set. The first act is about a quarter of the film. The second act is longer, it's about half the film, and the last section or the third act is the other quarter. And actually in my film class, I do this on the first week because I want people to be able to recognize the structure in any film that they might see.
Mm-hmm.
And that if the structure is observed, then the film is fairly well put together. So my example is Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, which is on the list of the greatest 100 British films of all time.
You had given me a heads up on that one. Yeah.
So, you know, in that film, you have a classic structure where this visitor from Canada, Mr. Hanny, you know, is suddenly, put in the middle of an espionage situation, also a murder situation.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to extricate himself from this. And the first act is very good because it sets up the whole story, but also presents his greatest problem. And that is that no one believes him. You know, to make his escape at the end of the first act, he puts on this jacket belonging to the milkman. And the milkman says, hey, what is this all about? So he tells them that there's been a murder in his apartment. There are these spies, and he's got to try and escape them. And the milkman goes, oh, go on, come on now. And then he says, well, you know, I'll tell you, really, I was upstairs visiting a lady. Oh, yes, a married lady. And now I'd like to leave. So why don't you? Well, that's her husband out there and her brother. Oh, why didn't you say so? You know, so he starts off, he realizes that he's got to lie and he cannot solve the problem that he has until he gets someone to believe him. And actually the young lady that you see in the photograph there, is a person who originally, fingers him to the police, and later on believes she has turned them over to the police, but eventually finds out he has been telling the truth and then helps him resolve the crime, if you will, and lead to the capture of the spy.
Mm.
The film has a lot of wonderful story elements to it. One of them is the idea that there's a lot of foreshadowing, and it has a very clear what we would call an initiating event. Now, most if you go by the theory of screenwriting, a play starts in some kind of stasis or normality, and then something happens that throws the world of the film into chaos. Mm-hmm. And in the 39 steps, it's these pistol shots that ring out in a music hall. And up until then, we're just enjoying a performance, you know, at the music hall. And these shots ring out, and Mr. Hanny gets involved with this spy who calls herself Annabella Smith, who winds up with a big knife in her back. And then he's got to sort of make his escape to try and find out what she was looking for, which was assistance from this fellow in Scotland. So he goes off to Scotland. He's chased by the police. And right in the middle of the film, we think he's got his relief. He thinks he's meeting the man that Annabella Smith wanted to meet. But instead, it's the villain. And he knows it's the villain because he's missing a piece of his little finger. And it's a kind of an uh-oh moment. You know, it's kind of like, now what? Well, you know, he's shot and appears to be dead, but the bullet actually enters a hymnal that he has in this coat that he's borrowed or stolen. And he then has to make several other escapes before he winds up at an inn where the henchman of the bad guy sort of spilled the beans. And the woman realizes he's been telling the truth. And it all ends again in, you know, which is a great sort of structural thing to go back to the beginning in a way. It ends in a music hall where the character Mr. Memory, who has committed this military secret to his brain, is performing. And Hanny puts two and two together. He sees the evil man up in the balcony, and we get our denouement. And it's really incredibly well structured. This was very typical of Hitchcock.
Well, I was going to ask you. I know Hitchcock was known for his. You mentioned the term cliffhanger. He was kind of known for that. But in general, what made him a great director? Everybody recognizes him as such.
Well, I think it's because he was able to understand how to manipulate the audience. Kind of like a great magician, you know, sort of like giving them clues and then kind of like, you know, confounding them with, you know, some contrary evidence or putting up these little vignettes, which are sort of like, you know, building up tension, then relieving the tension a little bit, and then building it up some more, and then relieving it, and leaving us to understand how is it all going to turn out. And I think he did that very well in his films. And I one thing that he was very fond of was the idea of characters talking to each other. And so here we get to dialogue. And the dialogue in the film is very witty at times, and has, if you will, an entertainment value all of its own. So I think anyone who went to a Hitchcock film was on a little bit of a roller coaster. I always say that there's a great value in kind of like thinking you know something and then finding out that it's not quite what you thought. And of course, that's pretty much the whole premise of Vertigo.
Right. Yeah, he did do a lot of, he seemed to like Jimmy Stewart, I think, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of people like Jimmy Stewart. I mean, he was a kind of an everyman kind of actor. He and Henry Fonda, you could plug them into a lot of different situations and have it have them work out well. So that's my example that I use for structure. And I talk about character development, you know, that in a good film, the character has grown over the course of the film. And so Mr. Hanny goes from being a kind of, you know, an interesting kind of guy, becomes very resourceful, very perceptive, deceptive, and insistent. you know, and so he evolves during the film. And that's kind of interesting because it doesn't always happen in an action adventure film, you know, like the 39 Steps.
Right. So that was he mastered structure.
Yeah, structure, yeah. And, you know, characters, presenting interesting characters, characters you want to watch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he was able to elicit very good performances from those actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was some of his others? Was, like you mentioned, Vertigo, he did The Birds, right?
Rope, which is an interesting experiment because it was done in 10-minute segments.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally, I believe, a play, and he staged it carefully so that there were these 10-minute clips that had no edits in them whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can talk about the value of being able to have what is sometimes called the long take, you know, where there's a long period where there's no edit, and the variety of visuals is derived from changing camera angles and the camera moving.
Mm. Oh, very good. So yeah, you gave me a couple other examples. I guess we're going to touch on the different elements of what makes a movie great. You had mm-hmm. mentioned On the Waterfront, 1954 movie.
Right. Yeah. Now with On the Waterfront, I chose that for cinematography. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it has all the other elements in it. It's got a great structure. It's got excellent character development. It's got a lot of symbolic elements to it. And it's very interesting because it's an American attempt at Italian neorealism. And of course, you know, it's got its Hollywood touches, but it was filmed on location. It does exhibit just about every camera movement you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It also has things like soft focus and hard focus, various ways of creating a focus within a frame for a character.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's in black and white, I think these things are very easy to see. And also, it also, accentuates one important aspect of cinematography, and that is that it's really all about light. And the lighting in the film is very carefully done.
That's a black and white film, right?
Yeah, black and white film. And again, you can see the lighting much better in a black and white film. You can understand its impact. You know, the idea of what we call low contrast or high contrast, where we have a very bright, evenly lit scene, or one where there's just, you know, one key light and a little bit of fill light. And backlight just to create this mystery of what can you see? Mm. It's almost as if you had a dimmer, you'd want to try to turn it up so that you could see more, but that's not the idea. We only want you to see certain things.
In this particular movie, there's a lot of outdoor scenes too.
Yes, and that sort of exemplified the on-location shooting. Now it's kind of interesting. There is in a screenplay, the first instruction of any scene is that it's indoor or outdoor, it's day or night, and I think that there's a lot to be said and to be studied about the choice of where you have a scene.
Mm-hmm.
Is the scene done in public? Outdoors, where theoretically anyone could observe it, or is it done in private, in indoor setting? And in On the Waterfront, we have several indoor settings, which are sort of very much keyed to the action at the time, where we need to be more intimate, where we need to be more expansive, where we need to have witnesses. You know, I always say that how do we know that Terry Malloy really requires redemption. And it's there's a scene where he's, you know, out there with Edie, and this guy comes along and says, who's a bum, and he calls Marlon Brando's character Terry a bum. And I say, even a bum thinks you're a bum, you know, sort of like you need a lot of redemption. And there are, you know, there are different areas that he has to climb. You know, he's got the legal hurdle of having this subpoena. He's got the moral obligation, the ethical obligation, and he's got this environment in which he lives, the docks. And I think one of the great scenes of the film, of course, is this climactic confrontation between him and Johnny Friendly in public with all of the other longshoremen looking on.
And on that boat, was it on a boat somewhere? Or?
Well, it's on a barge or a pier,
or a dock house,
where the little union building is.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's also interesting that in that film you have two contrasting scenes, one where Johnny Friendly is, you know, playing the Lord of the Manor in the back of the bar, and he's talking about all the great things that he's done for people, and there are all of these people who are not his guys in the room, and then when he is sending Charlie to either get Terry to agree to be quiet, or he has to basically turn him over to this guy who's going to bump him off. It's set in that very small, very hot, very sort of claustrophobic union building,
yes,
which is on the water. So, you know, it's all very carefully planned, the environment that you are experiencing as the audience, to help emphasize and, ramp up the emotions and the drama of the scene.
Right. Is this the movie that made Brando, or A Streetcar Named Desire?
Well, A Streetcar Named Desire sort of, made him, but, this was, the film that he got his, Academy Award for, I think, beat out Humphrey Bogart. It's a good film, and it was a way of introducing you know, the idea of this method acting to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. All of the people who were in the film were members of the Actors Studio, and they brought a new kind of sense of realism to the film. Mm-hmm. And that acting aspect is something that we might talk about when we talk about mise-en-scène, which is the next element. I think that, you know, there's such great cinematography. There's one scene where Terry bursts into the bar, and there's this light thrown on this pressed tin wall with a mount on it. It's just an incredible visual.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting that, like, the scenes on the rooftop are all filmed in a soft focus, because the rooftop where he keeps his pigeons is his refuge, and it's a refuge from the reality of the waterfront.
So there's a discerning difference between the cinematography on the roof versus the one down by the dock?
Oh yeah,
that the casual viewer of the movie wouldn't even notice, right?
Well, they might notice it. Mm. They might. You know, the roof is almost always enveloped in a kind of fog,
mm-hmm.
So it has this sort of otherworldly idea to it. I think the only time that a hard focus is used at the very end of the film, where one of his young friends has killed all his pigeons,
mm-hmm.
and he goes up on the roof and he realizes that the roof is not a refuge anymore, and he can't, he has to confront the reality of the docks. So he's got to have that confrontation with Johnny Friendly.
Hmm. Interesting. Having watched the movie, I don't think I noticed the difference. Well, I guess I wasn't looking out for the difference in the sharp focus versus the soft focus.
Well, it's not something that you would necessarily recognize, but in a way you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
See, because the cinematographer's job is to reinforce whatever mood is going on in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it with lighting. He does it with composition. He does it with the scaling of the actors, who's larger in the frame. He does it with, in other films with a choice of film stock. Mm-hmm. Is it a very sort of grainy or is it a very fine stock? If it's color, what is the color shift? Is it shifting cold? Is it shifting warm? Is it neutral?
Mm.
You might notice that, for example, in two films set in New York City, the comedy has a kind of amber glow to it, and the crime film has a kind of a steely blue look to it.
Yeah.
You know,
now that you mention it, yeah.
Yeah, and that's all part of the cinematography.
Boris Kaufman is the cinematographer. I don't know if you can see it on your screen, the picture of Boris Kaufman.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of his other works, do you know?
Well, I believe he's related to the Kaufmans who emigrated from Russia.
Mm-hmm. That's what it says here, yeah.
And he was probably one of the cinematographers on I'm trying to think of the film, but these early Soviet films, which were very experimental and exhibited great cinematography, like the works of Eisenstein.
Well, this definitely had an all-star cast. I don't know how many of these guys were actual stars when this was made. I certainly recognize them all. I guess they were coming into their own during this, like Lee Jacob and
Steiger. Rod Steiger, this was it was even Marie Saint's first film, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And of course Carl Malden had worked with Marlon Brando on Streetcar.
Mm-hmm.
His character as the priest is also very interesting. You know, he smokes, he drinks. He's a waterfront priest, you know, he's not, you know, he doesn't hide in his church.
I don't know if you could see the screen I'm sharing. It's the Wikipedia page for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't help but notice the budget for the movie. I don't know if you could see that. It was $910,000.
Yeah, that's not really a lot, I think. It's a good budget, but it's not ridiculous since, for example, the first million-dollar film was made in, like, in the early 30s.
Oh, well, I was going to say in 1954 it was a lot of money, but
yeah,
it's just funny to see $910,000, you know?
Yeah, now that, I don't know, you couldn't do very much with that amount of money.
You couldn't even buy the guy that does the camera work. But anyway, so the next movie on your list that you gave me was a newer movie and in color, The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Right. And I chose that because a lot of times when I talk about mise-en-scene, it really is basically every sort of visual that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the costume design, the set design. It's how the actors look, then their makeup, how they move, how they speak, you know, and, in French, the metteur en scène is the director. That's the word for director in French. And, a lot of times we think of the director as the person who is the arbiter of all of these choices. You know, he okays, the makeup, the costume, what the set looks like, and obviously, Wes Anderson, is someone, who kind of like is very much concerned with that look, And Grand Budapest Hotel, you know, sort of has a, it's almost an over-the-top mise-en-scene. The colors are very saturated. The actors, if you had like pictures of Hilda, of the various characters, William Dafoe, as he is and how he's depicted in the film, you know, there's a lot of what you might call transformations of the physicality of the actors and how they move. You know, because, you know, a comedy, characters move a lot more expressively in a way than in a drama. You know, and there's a great moment where, you know, Monsieur Gustave is approached by the police, and they said, they tell him that a murder's been committed. And you think I did it. And then he does this kind of like Marx Brothers about first and runs away, you know, and, you know, that's part of mise-en-scene, you know, how a character reacts and moves, how they say something is all part of that. And it could be something, you know, very sort of over the top, like in the Grand Budapest Hotel, or in the next example, something very subtle. Like in The Graduate, where Dustin Hoffman will make these little sounds at times, showing his discomfort, you know, and it's a very slight thing. It's a very subtle thing. So mise-en-scene can be over the top, or it can be very subtle. And well, this, it comes down to the choice of colors. For the, for example, in Grand Budapest Hotel, you have this great sort of contrast because the hotel goes through a transformation. You see it in its glory pre-World War II, and then you see it a kind of a shadow of itself in its sort of post-war Soviet kind of look, you know, where everything is nice and drab and all of the architectural ornaments have been knocked off the hotel, and it's suddenly, you know, almost a ghost of what it was.
You talk about an all-star cast, and again, I'm looking at a Wikipedia page for the Grand Budapest Hotel, and it's hard to believe all these people, they were able to, it's kind of like whoever didn't have a job at the moment was employed in the movie.
Well, you know, Wes Anderson is someone who can get people to work even small parts, you know, because they like being part of his films.
It reminds me of when I'm looking at the cast list: Jude Law, Harvey Keitel, Jeff Goldblum. It kind of reminds me of The Longest Day. If you ever saw the cast on The Longest Day, it's like whoever happened to be around, you can jump into the movie.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things about casting choices is that audiences, well, in some cases, you know, casting a certain person in a film is necessary to have it made. You know, you need a name.
To have it funded, you names. Mean? You need to have it funded, you mean?
Yeah, to have it funded. Right. For example, Terry Gilliam was doing Brazil, and he was having an awful time getting funding. And he got Robert De Niro to play a part. And it's not a major part in the film. It's an important part. But the fact that he's there allows him to have Jonathan Pryce and Bob Hoskins, you know, who are not big box office marquee names, you know. And you know, you need that. Now, in Grand Budapest Hotel, you have a bunch of people who like, you know, like him and Wes Anderson, and they want to dress up and what do you want me to do? You know, that kind of thing. So he has that going for him. And a lot of the you might not recognize Harvey Keitel, for example, or William Dafoe in this film. You do, but they're almost like expressionistic caricatures of how they actually look.
I was, you know, it's the first time I've considered what you just said I wonder if there's a system in place in Hollywood whereby an agent says, you know, you can have my guy, or I should say, I know a guy who will kick in for some of the funding of the production if you take my guy on the cast. That's got to happen, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure it's known. I mean, it's the, you know, producers sort of are sort of risk managers, and one way that they try to sort of manage risk is in casting. Mm-hmm. I was reading that when Goldfinger was being made, they originally wanted Orson Welles to be Goldfinger, but he was too expensive.
I was going to say that would have been odd.
Yeah. And so they got this German actor, and he had to have a lot of his lines dubbed because he didn't speak English very well. And then at one point he was demanding 10% of the gross, and the producers were thinking, I think Orson Welles would have been cheaper. So there's all of that sort of thing going on. But sometimes it's necessary to get the funding to do the film.
Right.
You know, and directors and, you know, screenwriters very often, screenwriters will even sort of like write films with a particular person in mind.
Right.
And we'll send them the script and say, hey, how would you like to do this? You know, but there's always a lot of sort of wheeling and dealing behind the scenes about that.
I just never contemplated that before. I appreciate you pointing that out. As a vast contrast to On the Waterfront, you can, I don't know if you can see the budget of this movie. It's $25 million, but it made $173 million. So. Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, the way money works in a film is that you take the cost of production and you double it for distribution, advertising, et cetera. And then you look at the box office receipts. And of course, the theaters keep some of the receipts. You know, they're renting the film, but they're also keeping, you know, a percentage of the tickets.
Right.
So a film that costs, you said, $35 million.
Well, it says 25 here on Wikipedia.
25.
Yeah.
So the break even point for that film was $50 million. Very successful film.
Well, everybody's got to get their slice. That's for sure. Yeah. Before we get to the next movie, what do you think the future of cinemas are? People going into the cinema to watch a movie as opposed to how easy it is to watch it at home nowadays, even new movies.
I think one of the things that makes film an interesting medium is that it was designed to be seen in a very large, dark room on a very large screen with excellent sound. And the idea of this transportation of space and time, if it's successful, actually transports the audience. Now you could be able to do that maybe in a darkened living room with a gigantic screen TV and you know, good sound system, but there's also a sort of a communal aspect to it. Of an audience laughing or gasping,
the shared experience.
Yeah, the shared experience, or even their anxiety, their tension, which is in the room. You know, and so, well, for example, this Sunday, I'm going to the cinemas in Poughkeepsie to see Casablanca. Casablanca is going to be shown on the big screen. And I've only seen Casablanca maybe 50 or 60 times.
Times have you seen it on the big screen, though?
Just once before in Greenwich Village Cinema. probably about 50 years ago.
Right.
So, so I'm looking forward to it because that's the way film is supposed to be seen. Now, you see, you can see the story, you can get the story, and you can get maybe some of the effect of the cinematography and the mise-en-scène if you're watching it on a small screen on your phone or on a tablet or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you are missing out on a lot.
Right.
For example, I thought it was very interesting. Martin Scorsese had never thought a lot of one of the great films, kind of like the first romantic comedy, It Happened One Night.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it had to do with the fact that he had never seen it on a big screen.
Mm.
And of course, being a famous, very wealthy director, he has his own screening room. And he decided to show it, I think for his children. And he was watching it and he had a whole new appreciation of the film and realized sort of its greatness. Because that scale is part of the design.
Mm-hmm.
There's a moment in The Maltese Falcon. It's a very minor scene. Humphrey Bogart is asleep. And, in the frame, we see one of those old stick telephones.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it rings. And it's kind of like, out of this silence, it's kind of deafening. And then, Bogart, rubs his face and he picks up the phone and he finds out that his partner's been shot,
mm-hmm.
And he has to go to it. But I was looking at that and I was saying, when the phone is, half an inch tall in your tablet or on your phone, a quarter inch, it doesn't really have any presence.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's like 8 feet tall on a big screen,
mm-hmm.
it has presence.
Right.
So I think that while people, have to a great extent said to themselves, well, I've got to pay $24 for two tickets or I can buy the DVD or now I can just wait till it's streaming. Yeah, people are doing that. And I guess what they're doing is they're getting the gist of the film, if you will, the content of the film, but they're not getting the film experience.
Well, actually, it sets up the next question I had for you, Professor, which was, are directors and cinematographers and screenwriters, are they applying their craft with that knowledge in mind? Like this is going to be on somebody's laptop or this is going to be in somebody's screening room in their home.
I don't think so. No. I mean, not yet anyway. Mm-hmm. I had a sort of a discussion with someone about our kind of like way of orienting a screen. Like right now we're in landscape.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of TikTok is in portrait
mm-hmm.
mode. Mm-hmm. And someone saying that portrait mode is becoming more acceptable. But it's anyone who has been trained in photography or film knows that you only use portrait mode when you're doing a still portrait. And even then, very often a portrait that is well executed in landscape mode is usually a lot more interesting.
Mm. Just to amplify that, I as an example, you mentioned Scorsese. Now he made The Irishman specifically for Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it was ever released in a theater.
I saw it in a theater.
Oh, I was going to say maybe it had on a limited run in a theater. But yes. it was designed specifically for Netflix.
Right.
And the points you're bringing up now make me wonder, does he change his approach to filmmaking with that in mind,
Well, he was very much opposed to the idea that people would be watching it on some kind of small device. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of times right now in people's houses, I mean, when television was first introduced, there was a 9-inch screen, and basically there were a lot of close-ups and not much background. And then as the screen got bigger, it became more cinematic. And in fact, I Love Lucy was one of the first television productions that was done on 35 millimeter film, and where they actually hired a cinematographer, to make it look more movie-like.
But now there's millions of people that watch movies on a 5-inch screen with their cell phone.
Right.
Or their Kindle, say.
Yeah, I don't know why they would want to, except that, you know, okay. Well, it's okay. It's kind of like maybe you just want to get the story. You just want to say that you saw the movie. And maybe you want to key in on performances or that aspect of mise-en-scène, but you're not really getting the effect of the film.
Right.
And actually, the Netflix films are very cinematic, and I think they're assuming, to some degree, that people are seeing them on very large screen televisions. I can't imagine why anybody would want to have a large screen television to watch, for example, the evening news. It's not very cinematic, or even the way a lot of sort of reality shows or
sports.
Sports you'd want to see on a big screen. I mean, when you think about what you get to see with, for example, an NFL game, you'd be crazy to freeze your buns off in some stadium somewhere, where you could get the advantage of 30 cameras, including one that is hovering over the field.
Not to mention replay.
Yeah. Yeah. I know with baseball, I'd love to turn off the commentary and just get the crowd sound. But
Right. Well, it's, I can see to your point before about Casablanca, you're going to see Casablanca on this coming weekend, and I can see a cinema's usefulness for that, an old classic movie that deserves to be on the big screen. But I just, as a business model, I don't know what the future for theaters are, cinemas.
Yeah, they're struggling. I mean, they've got stadium seating, and of course there's kind of outrageous prices for drinks and popcorn and such. They had to invest a lot of money to get digital projectors.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember going to a movie once, and the film started to jump in the gate, and people are screaming in the theater. And I went out and I went upstairs to the projection booth, and there was nobody there. And it was one of those cinemas where there's like 8 movies going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It was like being on one of those Star Trek episodes where they beam onto the abandoned ship. And I got to the projector, and I corrected the film in the gate, and the film was now going normally. But the films were on these big spools,
right? Yeah,
and they were just taking up the spools. It's not like in the old days where the projectionist was there and looking for the little signal to switch over to the second projector. Mm. And then he had to, and it was a very sort of hands-on thing. Digital projection, of course, now is, much easier.
It's probably computerized also.
Yeah, you open the file, but
you open the file, right? Yeah.
But and also distribution is easier because the file is sent. You don't have cans of film that are making
electronically, right.
Yeah, place to place. So that's cut down probably on some of the cost of it. And of course, actually, the internet has probably also helped the advertising budget to some degree. Since a lot of trailers will appear on, for example, Facebook,
mm-hmm.
And I know you have, they're paying for that, but it's probably less money than kind of national advertising campaigns that were taken on network television and magazines and newspapers.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, I steered you away from your list, which I apologize for, but the next one on it is The Graduate from 1967.
Right. Now, the Graduate, you know, I talk about editing with The Graduate, but obviously, you know, it's a kind of an incremental effect. The mise-en-scène in The Graduate is much more subtle. You have a suburban house, but it's got a lot of interesting details. You know, Benjamin is, you know, he's got his fish tank, and later on he's forced to perform in his wetsuit, and he's like the little frogman that's in the fish tank. You know, and
that's Dustin Hoffman, right?
Dustin Hoffman. And then you've got this sort of this really ugly clown painting in the hallway. And then the Robinson's house is, you know, it's a sort of a very sort of typical, you know, upper middle class house, which is also got its, you know, indications of a certain amount of classlessness. You know, Mr. Robinson, you know, comes in and he's going to smoke a cigar. So he bites off the end and he spits it out, you know. So, you know, so there are all of these little very sort of subtle mise-en-scene touches, you know, that shows that mise-en-scene can be very subtle as well as over the top, as in Grand Budapest Hotel. But also the editing is very good. And editing is really a question of how long can you see an image? What are you supposed to get out of it? Who you should be looking at a particular time? You know, is it more important to look at the person for us to see the person who is speaking or the person who is receiving the message? And that's all part of editing. And of course, in comedy, it's also a question of timing. You know, how long should a shot be? It takes a tenth of a second for the human eye to recognize a stimulus and another tenth of a second for it to process the image. And this is why baseball players then have probably about another tenth of a second to decide to swing or not. But you know, but film works in the same way in that you know, we can recognize something sort of in the very early on in that film. You know, Mrs. Robinson has told Benjamin to look at Elaine's portrait in her bedroom. So he's looking at the portrait, and suddenly Mrs. Robinson enters the room naked. And Benjamin is like, you know, going crazy. And there's this cutting back and forth between him being very uncomfortable and going, oh my God, oh Jesus, oh God. And little flashes of Mrs. Robinson's body, you know, then, which is what he's looking at. And it's very effective editing because, you know, it's almost like he can't help but look, and we can't help but look, but we don't want to look, and we don't want to, you know, we don't want to buy into what she's selling. She says, well, you don't have to sleep with me this time, Benjamin, but I want you to think about it, that kind of thing. And then, of course, he hears the car screeching, and it's Mr. Robinson, and he pushes her out of the way, oh, unlocks the door and runs downstairs, and he's like trying to be all kind of like calm and whatever. And then he has his little scene with Mr. Robinson. And again, you know, in great film, there's always this kind of sort of like the before and after scene. So in that scene that follows, Mr. Robinson is there. First of all, I always think it's very funny, very subtle. He says, what are you drinking, bourbon or scotch? And he says bourbon, and he pours him a scotch.
Oh, yeah?
No. Yeah. he never gets what he wants. But you know, he's in this drink, and Mr. Robinson is the lord in his castle, and he's in complete control, and he's talking slowly, and he says, "Benjamin, how long have I known you? How long have you, your father and I been partners?" And he's like, you know, taking his time and whatever. And then later on, he confronts Benjamin in this little attic apartment, and he's completely lost all control. You know, he's completely at wit's end, and he's gone from this big to this big.
Mm.
And he's gone from his castle to this very constricted space, you know, and he's saying that Benjamin is raising his voice when he's yelling at him, when he's not even raising his voice. He's saying that Benjamin is threatening him when he's just holding up his hand, you know, and it's a great contrast. Murray Hamilton does a very good job in that part, seeing that contrast. But the editing, also has a couple of very interesting touches. You know, editing is how we know time passes.
Mm-hmm.
And so Benjamin is following Elaine around at the college, and he asks her a question, and she disappears into a classroom. And then a bell rings, and people are coming out of the classroom, and he goes, "Well," and, you know, we know that the whole class period has elapsed, you know, and it's all done with, you know, one cut and the sound of a bell. And that's kind of like, you know, one of the great things about editing is that you've got these choices. There may be five setups, sometimes seven setups in a scene. Think about a Sergio Leone film where, you know, we're seeing that final gunfight. We have the wide shot of the three men and the good, bad, and the ugly, you know, standing in like a triangle, you know, trying to figure out who's going to shoot who and who's going to draw first and whatever. And then we get to close-ups of each man. And then we get extreme close-ups of each man where we're just looking at their eyes. And that's all part of, you know, the tension is created by the editing.
Right. I didn't realize about, I like when I find little subtle nuances, like the guy orders the bourbon and he gets a scotch. I wonder how many of those are that people don't, how many people you think notice that?
I don't know. I think if you're, it's part of the subtlety of it, you know, that if you're really paying attention, you get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I always say in a very good film, nothing you're looking at is not is by chance. Mm. Sometimes, you know, lines are ad-libbed and they stay in the movie. My favorite one being Tommy Lee Jones, you know, in The Fugitive. You know, I think Harrison Ford says, "But I didn't kill my wife." And I think Tommy Lee Jones was supposed to say, "That doesn't matter," or something like that. Mm-hmm. And instead he ad-libbed, "I don't care."
Mm.
And it's, you know, it's a brilliant line. But everything is there because it has been planned that way.
Mm-hmm.
And even when there is an ad-lib that winds up sort of getting into the film, very often filmmakers will surprise actors because they want a genuine reaction.
Mm.
And sometimes you have actors who the amateur actor, I mean, I'll give you just this little hint from being a director. You know when the amateur actor gives their best performance?
Uh-uh.
Opening night.
Mm.
And the reason for that is that, you know, they work towards that moment. And if it's been successful, what they try to do is make a Xerox copy. Instead of doing the performance from the beginning, living in the moment, they try to replicate what they did the night before.
Right.
And it usually is like a bad Xerox copy.
Yeah, unless they sucked on opening night.
Well, yeah, they might actually get better. But yeah. But there was an actor, Frank Sinatra, for example. He was known to be, his best take was his first take. Hmm. So directors who knew him, John Frankenheimer, for example, the Manchurian Candidate, would carefully rehearse the scene and carefully rehearse the camera and the movement because he was hoping that, he would only have to do one take because he knew that that was going to be Frank's best performance.
Wow. Mm. Did you like him as an actor, Frank Sinatra?
I think he could be effective. I he was certainly effective in From Here to Eternity.
Like Von Ryan's Express is one movie that sticks out.
Okay. I don't know if I saw that.
Oh, no.
Now, I have to say I'm not a very big Sinatra fan. I'm not a big Joe DiMaggio fan either. I don't know why, but.
Yeah. Well, everything is subjective, including what we're talking about tonight. But, So the last movie on your list, which is, again, relatively new from 2002, Chicago. Which I guess is it the film adaptation of the play?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And kind of like done as a bit of an homage to Bob Fosse. Mm-hmm. Rob Marshall, the director, does a lot of Fosse-like touches and actually, sort of goes back and forth between a kind of realism and an expressionistic theater-like environment in the film. And I chose it as an example of two things in my class. One was the use of sound. Mm-hmm. And you would think, oh yeah, well, it's a musical, so that's a no-brainer. But really there's a lot of very sort of subtle blends, overlapping of sound. That is a technique, by the way, in editing, is to have the sound from one scene bleed into the next scene, or you hear the sound first and then you cut to the scene. And there's a lot of that in Chicago, as well as this going back and forth between what appears to be the realism of the story and a lot of the musical numbers, which are done kind of like in sometimes very exotic, exaggerated ways, like the manipulation of the press figures as they're seen as puppets, that the lawyer played by Richard Gere is manipulating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems with musicals, musicals that were on Broadway, for example, can or cannot translate to the screen well. It, like, as an example, Les Miserables, I thought stunk on the movie. I saw it on Broadway.
And you liked it on Broadway?
I did like it on Broadway, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think it's a question of any adaptation requires you to throw out the source to some degree.
And what do you mean?
Well, like, for example, if you're adapting a novel, you can't adapt it page for page. Mm-hmm. And if you are doing a Broadway show, you've got to say, well, what elements of that production are cinematic, mm-hmm. and what aren't? For example, there was a project called, I think, the American Film Theater or something. It was a series of films that were made from Broadway plays. Mm-hmm. And one of them was 1776.
Ah, okay.
And in the film, they basically just sort of set it with very little interpolation of other sets or scenes. you know, it was almost like watching the stage play.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in that case, the material was so tight that it worked.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I like the adaptation of The Iceman Cometh was not very successful, in my opinion, because the play is kind of static and it takes place in the bar, you know, and whatever. But you've got to then have the camera moving. You've got to have a lot of cutaways. You've got to maybe add a little something in terms of action to it, even if that action is sort of extraneous to the text, to make it more cinematic. Like I thought, for example, the adaptation of Fences was very good. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it can be done.
Oh, it's been done many times. It's just, but it just seems like it can fail stupendously sometimes. Like by Birdie was done well. West Side Story was done well in their film adaptations. But I don't know, things like Les Miserables. Just I'm also thinking of Evita.
Uh huh.
Yeah, there are some times where it doesn't translate well to the big screen from Broadway.
Right. Right. And, you know, part of that might, there are all kinds of compromises that can be made and done. And sometimes people who are making a film, you know, don't recognize the necessity of changing things around.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, I think most people would say that Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of Stephen King's The Shining is a much better film than the 6-part TV adaptation that was very close to the book.
Mm.
You know, and I think the secret of adaptation is, you know, here's the material, but how do we make it into a movie?
Mm.
And anything is possible.
Mm.
You know, and if you just kind of like, give it a real backdrop instead of a stage backdrop, that's not going to do it.
Right. Right.
You know, and maybe you've got to change the dialogue, and maybe you have to eliminate characters, and maybe you have to eliminate, you know, in most musical films, any number of songs, for example, that were in the original are eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of that selection process,
right?
You know, which are the ones that are going to work. I thought Chicago was brilliantly adapted because, you know, there was a song for each character.
Mm-hmm.
And, when the character was doing their song, you know, an entire scenario was created for that song and for that character that, you know, was very well done.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Cellophane, for example, or even when Queen Latifah does her number and, you know, she's transformed from this warden in the girls' prison to this blues star of the 20s on the stage acting, you know, in an outrageous, lascivious manner, you know, and then going back to, you know, her character.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, for example, when you do it right, adaptation is a transformation, where you can see the source material, but the source material's essence has taken precedence over its literal progression.
Right. No, that's a good point. Before I let you go, Professor Pucci, I have to ask you. Now, we touched on a lot of things that go into making a great movie great. I appreciate your time tonight. I have to ask you, and this is subjective, but Have you ever seen a movie that had great cinematography, had great nuance, great screenplay, but just the movie sucked anyway?
I wouldn't say that that I've seen that. I mean, I wouldn't say that it sucked. I could say that maybe I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, well, that's it. It is subjective.
But I think that I always think that, and I've done this my entire career, starting in theater. It's like, how does one evaluate a play production? How does one evaluate a film? And I always say it's the degree to which it satisfied its objective. Mm-hmm. And the objective, you know, is in the text. You know, if it was a comedy, did people laugh on a very basic level? Mm-hmm. If it was a drama, did they identify strongly with the protagonist? You know, I always say that, you know, Saving Private Ryan is successful because you feel bad about Tom Hanks dying, his character dying, even though on some level we know he's in his New York apartment playing with his typewriters. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, it's that, well, you know, in the theater we call it the willing suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. We know we're watching a play, but we start to think of the people that we're watching as real.
Right.
And I think that any film where we have that empathy for the characters, you know, can't be all bad. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say there are directors, you know, and Stanley Kubrick could be part of them, where there isn't necessarily that great empathy for the character. You know, you don't feel a great empathy for example, the characters in 2001: A Space Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And you are sort of asked to ignore them for the spectacle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe some people, you know, don't like his films because of that aspect of them. Mm-hmm. You know, they like a strong identification of the character. Mm-hmm. Or characters that you can like. Mm-hmm. Like Ryan O'Neal and Barry Lyndon. You can't like him. You know, he's you know, he goes through these transformations that has taken him from being this sort of lackadaisical, you know, Byron-esque romantic, to this sort of very sort of cold, calculating, dissipated fortune seeker. Mm-hmm. You know, but he's not what you're watching. Mm-hmm. You know, you're watching a picaresque novel being translated, a Thackeray novel being translated from film. I don't think you're supposed to like him. Mm-hmm. But in most films, you know, we have a protagonist that we empathize with. We want to see them do well. We want to see them succeed. Mm-hmm. And I think that when a film fails, it's because a lot of times it's structural. A lot of times it's, I mean, there are not a lot of examples of bad cinematography. Mm-hmm. I always think of, I used to show this in my class. I showed the original Little Shop of Horrors, mm-hmm. which was shot in 2 days. Hmm. Yeah, it's sort of like one take, no problem. I only have like $20,000. I got to get this done.
And what about the other? What about that other one? The Dawn of the Dead.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that looked like real low budget, but the storyline was interesting enough.
Right, right. I mean, sometimes the story or the actors, you know, can make up for, you know, kind of like low production values.
Right, Right.
And I think that one of the things that I think shows that is kind of like, you know, the successes of early television shows, like The Twilight Zone. It very often was using like borrowed scenery, borrowed costumes, you know, and it was really about the story and about the actors' performances.
That's true. Sometimes that makes it more endearing, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen any of the movies of Ed Wood.
Yeah, I believe I have. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, talk about low budget, no budget. Talk about, you know, where are we going to get the props? What does your kitchen look like? you know, paper plates for flying saucers and stuff like that.
Yeah. If not endearing, at least it makes it interesting to watch.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Some of those sets on the Twilight Zone, it's like, don't make a right into that wall because the wall might tip over because it looked like it was made out of cardboard.
Well, you know? And it probably was.
It probably was.
You know, and a lot of times they recycled, props and scenery from other films, you know, and, you know, everything was borrowed.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it shows that, you know, it's really a question of resourcefulness. And if you're telling a good story, people, you know, can ignore that. Mm-hmm. I always said that about speakers. You know, mm-hmm. if what you're trying to say is really important, no one really notices how you're dressed. They don't notice whether you speak well or not, if you have an expressive voice or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've known some professors who are extremely effective, and they have little quiet voices,
mm-hmm.
and you almost have to strain to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
But you do, because what they're saying is good. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important. And yeah. I think film is the same way. I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be the Grand Budapest Hotel. You know, it can be The Graduate. You know, it can be the 39 steps. It can be a really, you know, kind of very constricted movie, like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf,
mm-hmm.
where the intensity of the performances makes you forget that, you know, basically the scene's not shifting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll have to have you back, Professor, to just talk about yours and my favorite movies.
Okay.
From a non-studious point of view, just what you liked, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, short of rolling in the projector, I think we took a good glimpse into what your classroom was like, and I do appreciate your time tonight.
You're welcome.
And we'll see you further on up the road, sir.
Okay, very good.
Thanks again.
All right, take care.